Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Hey, y'all, I'm KC.
And I'm Tyler.
And this is the Elk Hunting Series from the Element Podcast.
If you want to get on elk, it helps to hang with dudes that know elk.
And that ain't us, but luckily the dudes that know elk have cell phones, and we called them up.
So whether you're a veteran of September or you're just cutting your ivories in the elk woods, you're going to hear something here that'll help you get the full draw this fall.
If you find this podcast helpful, poke that subscribe button and go check out our elk hunting playlist on YouTube. Now let's rock and roll. All right, y'all, on the show tonight, we have got none other than Brian Broderick of Day 6 Gear. Brian, crazy uncle, what's up, man?
Oh, my God.
Crazy Uncle B, it's what we call him, or Bri-Bri, one of the two.
Bri-Bri.
How are things down in the Gulf Coast today, man?
I thought I was Uncle Daddy.
I don't think I can call any other fella daddy.
We
I'm
call
sorry.
That Dunkle, actually.
Dunkle.
It's just hot.
Yeah.
That's it.
Did y'all get any of that cool front that we got today?
Yeah, it dipped down to a frigid 93 today.
That's same here, man.
That's what we got.
It's nice. Mm-hmm. Well, when it was 103 yesterday, 93 is pretty intense temperature drop, you know.
Yeah, me without my parka.
I know. Oh, that's right, man. Well, we have talked to you extensively about elk hunting this season off air, and we thought it would be a pretty good time to get you on to, you know, just convey some of that knowledge, make sure people didn't think we were lying when we told them that you'd actually killed some stuff. What's your plans for elk
season? Are you want me to, like, give them all the spots I gave y'all?
Yeah. That's kind of was the point, you know.
I mean, at least the unit numbers.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What's your plans for elk this year, since they change every time I talk to you?
I'm going to take a little...
Making it up. He's making it up right now. He's making it up.
I'm a little hesitant to talk about it because of this COVID stuff, and I'm not sure what the rules are, where I'm going, and I can't play stupid if I sit on a podcast that I actually know what the rules are.
Gotcha. Well, just tell us when you're going. How about that?
Yeah, I'm going to New Mexico. Same place I went last year.
Yeah.
Where y'all saw me last year?
Yep, we did. We shared a delicious breakfast of green chiles. And did Tyler tell you his green chiles story? Do you know that one?
I can believe that, but with you two, that it was pronounced Childs.
No, it wasn't between us two. Yeah.
You remember, I'm a son of an English teacher, you know, so I'm not too dumb.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I wasn't talking about you.
Yeah.
That narrows it down.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, you actually helped us out quite a bit last year because we were kind of newbies with a unit that I drew there in New Mexico, and you'd hunted it a few times, and we actually got to talking long before we really, you know, did much together at all. I just called you up to ask some questions about Arras and just kind of got talking about elk hunting, and you figured out that I was going to the Gila Wilderness area down there, and you hunted it quite a few times. And then through conversations in the past year or two, we've been talking, and apparently you've just hunted elk for 86 seasons, I think it is now. So I was hoping 87. Yeah. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to short you one there, but
yeah.
How? First of all, we were exaggerating a little bit, but you really have done a ton of elk hunting, especially for a guy who's from the Gulf Coast, right? How did you?
Yeah.
How did you do that, man? How have you gone? And you're not an old guy.
Well, he's somewhere between, somewhere between 40 and 75, right?
Yeah.
I can't really tell.
He's built like a high school wrestler, you know, you know, about a buck 35, you know, whatever. But how did you, first of all, decide that you wanted to go do the elk thing so much and you know, figure all this stuff out through the years?
Well, first off, before we get into that, y'all made a comment before we got on the air that that y'all would see come September if I knew what I was talking about or not.
Uh-huh.
And that is not fair because the results of whether I know what I'm talking about or not cannot be based on whether you two goobers close the deal or not.
Well, Brian, the measure of a hunt is not if you kill something or not. Don't you know the PC answer to this? It's about the experience.
No.
He's like, no, I done killed everything out west.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just, I don't want you guys coming back with three arrows left between the two of you and say, we didn't kill one, it's your fault.
Hey, I didn't do that last year. Now,
we
come
won't
on.
Publicly. We won't do that publicly.
That's right.
Publicly.
Yeah.
Public. I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, honestly, I was just, you know, of course, obsessed with hunting, and for whatever reason, you know, all the magazines and stuff that I would read, I was always kind of fixated on the Western stuff, you know, and back then it was Outdoor Life and Field and Stream and, you know, Eastman's, Fur Fish and Game, you know, those were the things that I, you know, really, really kind of was, you know, drawn to. And then as when I started getting, you know, in high school, I, had a youth leader at my church, that had lived out west, for a time, and did some welding on oil rigs out there. And when he came back home, he was continuously going out in the fall and hunting public land. And so, in 1991, he asked me if I wanted to go with him to New Mexico, and I did at, I guess that would have been 18 years old, 19 years old, 19 years old. So that was my first trip out there, and had no idea where we were going. I relied on him, you know. He had all the paper maps. There was no internet or any of that, Google Earth, any of that.
Yep.
So he had all the paper maps. And honestly, to this day, he's still one of the best all-around outdoorsmen I've ever been around. The guy just, he just got it naturally, you know. Incredible trapper, incredible bow hunter, incredible fisherman, just and the hardest working guy ever. I mean, you know, he probably weighed the same thing I did, but his calves were like my thighs. I mean, he just was this, you know, physical specimen. And
well, like me, right?
But yeah, right.
Yep.
And so, you know, I had to keep up with that guy the first time I went out there, and it was a pretty big learning curve. I missed three bulls in 14 days of hunting.
Were you shooting one of those old PSC fire flights, or what was the going thing back then?
Back then, it was a high country sniper.
Mm, yeah, high country. Yep. That's not around anymore. I've seen a few of them, though, I think, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was back in the day, man. That was, yeah, that was Lee Jeans and
yeah,
the whole deal.
Did you blame it on the brass sights, or did you just own up to it?
No, I mean, you know, it's wide open, and there's a, you know, 700-pound animal standing out there. I'd been judging yardage on whitetails and hogs and stuff my entire life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd look at it and go, oh, he's 30. And I'd zing one at his feet, you know, and he was 50. So I just, it took me a while to get that. You know, I'd never hunted in such open country. It'd always been thick timber. And then I'd never hunted anything that big. So that whole season, that whole off season, I basically went around my uncle's cow pasture and I shot his cows with rubber blunts.
oh my gosh.
I was judging, you know, trying to judge yardage out in the open pasture on those cows. And until I got caught, because like when we would come out to catch cows and work cows, they would literally run through the fences. I mean, they'd almost gotten feral, like wild cattle.
They didn't like that redheaded guy, did they?
They didn't realize that I'd been out there for 6 months whacking them with a rubber blunt with my bow. And so I just figured I was tenderizing them a little bit, you know. Yeah. But anyway, that was an incredible advantage for me, because the next year I went out there, I was dialed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just to put it in perspective, so in 91... I had no idea where I was going the first time, and we went to 16A in New Mexico. Gosh. I don't mind saying a unit, because anybody listening, you ain't going to draw it.
Can't draw it.
Good luck. Yeah.
Yeah, good luck. So we applied again in 92, drew it again.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep. Man. And then did not draw it in 93. Well, in 93... he wanted to go moose hunting, so he went moose hunting, and I went out there by myself because he had sworn me to secrecy. So my second choice was B, where you guys went last year. So that's when I did my walkabout and like 20 miles from where I was supposed to be. Had to pay somebody to drive me back. Mm-hmm. Drive me back to the place I had no idea how to get to or where I was parked. So that was 93, and then 94, we drew 16A again.
Oh, my goodness.
But 3 out of 4 years, we drew it, and then 95, I went by myself again and drew 15. And back then, it was 15A and B, and I can't remember which one I went to, but I think it was the north side. But anyway, so, I mean, I was drawing New Mexico every year, and then it started kind of petering out, and I had to do a little more research to get some higher odd units.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started venturing over into like the 12s, the 13s, you know, the 34s, 36s, all that stuff, you know, 23s. Back then it wasn't 23, it was something else. But anyway, I mean, I've had the opportunity to hunt New Mexico quite a bit over the last 19 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be right? 1991.
You already know. Okay. I don't do math.
That's no, 29.
That's 29 years, isn't it?
Yep.
That's a long time, man.
That gummit, dude.
I was 3.
Yep. 3 with a mullet.
That's right.
I can picture it.
Actually, did have a mullet. Yeah, you're right.
Mm.
We call it a cowboy cut.
We need to do a comparison.
Oh, dude. Yep. I was a sharp little kid.
I bet.
Let me tell you. Yeah, but
yeah, I had hair down to my butt until I was 7 or 8. My parents were hippies, and so I have no room to say anything.
So, well,
everybody thought I was a girl till I was 10 when I got my hair cut.
So you're 10.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well,
because my hair was so long. But anyway,
to your 40, maybe.
Yeah, to your 40, maybe. No.
Yeah. Oh. So in 96, I started hunting Idaho and Colorado, started hunting those states because I didn't draw New Mexico. And then somehow or another, it got to be to the point to where I was pretty much quitting my job, putting my camper shell on my truck. My tag, my Alabama tag, said Wapiti on it. That was my tag.
Man. Yeah.
And nobody knew what it meant. So
except for Mike and TK.
Well, one of my buddies looked it up, and he said, well, it's an Indian term for, you know, white butt, white rump. So they thought that I had my tag meant, you know, white, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So white butt, you know. Mm-hmm. And it meant elk. Ain't nobody in town knew about to do that. But anyway.
That's when you know the joke's good, when you're the only guy that gets it.
Yeah, that's right. But so I started hunting like Idaho early season, and then I would come out and go to Colorado and hunt around that Meeker area, you know, for 10 days or so. And then I would go down to New Mexico and hunt. And I'd pretty much stay gone for, you know, about 5 weeks. And I did that every year for a long time. And then as we started to have children, you know, Jackie was just asking that I start to take somebody with me. She didn't like the idea of me being by myself.
Yeah.
So that's when I started, you know, the struggles of having to carry somebody hunting with me.
Yeah. We still haven't got the invite on that one yet, so.
One day.
Maybe one day, you know.
We've had the invite, and then it got pulled. You know, we were going to go to Alabama, and then we didn't, so it's fine.
Hey, I got a question.
Whose fault was that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I guess it was Tyler. I don't know.
Yeah, it was me.
Okay.
It was me. It was me. Hey, what? Yeah. So okay. Here's my question though: is did you start putting in for sheep points anytime back then? Because you and I have talked about the fact you're not really that driven to do the sheep thing. But I was kind of hoping you had a bunch of points you could transfer over to me or something.
No, no. You know, I'll be honest with you. The sheep hunting back then, the public land sheep population wasn't what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that is that
same amount of tags available.
Right, pretty much. I mean, very little but the other side of that, guys, is that you didn't really have the resources back then that you have now to know how many points it takes in this unit in this state. That stuff wasn't there. I mean, you were literally physically mailing in your request for topo maps and mailing in a handwritten check in a letter, you know, for Forest Service maps. And you were mailing in your draw applications. And it was just a very, you know, you were kind of in the dark on everything, you know? I mean, there was no... Heck, there wasn't even GPSs. Yeah. You know, you're following a compass and a paper map. So, but anyway, it just, the other side of it is, and I mean, I don't want this to sound bad, but, you know, I looked into sheep hunting back then, and it wasn't that expensive.
Mm.
So I thought, well, heck, that's just something I'll do one day. and then one day I looked, and I thought, what in the heck happened?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I can't go get a new truck if I want to go sheep hunting because it costs the same. Yep. It's like overnight it went from $5,000 to hunt sheep to 20.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how it was. And I remember looking at a couple of hunts that I was going to do and I really got serious about it. And I was about to pull the trigger on one and I drew a New Mexico tag. And so I was like, well, heck, I can't pass that up.
Yeah.
You know, and it just never happened.
Yeah.
But now, as expensive as it is, I just, no matter what financial position I'm in, I don't know that I would ever be to a point to where I could justify spending $30,000 or $40,000 on a self-serving deal like that. You know, I don't know. It just doesn't feel right, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing a lot of dudes are probably having to balance. That's one of those things, man. Like, since I was pretty little, sheep were, like, the coolest thing, man, to me. And I just don't see myself, especially if this is the career path that I'm taking. Yeah. Like, somebody's going to have to offer me the hunt pretty much at this point, you know?
Well, I mean, if you stay on this path, I mean, you're going to be looking at those – sheep inside those pens in Texas.
Well, I've already done
that. Hey, old Texas doll ain't
been there, done that.
Yeah, $100 a day deals.
Yeah,
that's right.
So much fun.
Three-legged mouflons down here, pretty cheap, man. You know, so. Oh man,
I wouldn't pay it. I mean, I can't. I don't know. I guess I don't know if I'm a cheapskate or whatever, but it just doesn't seem.
Oh, we know
it just
you are.
Doesn't seem right.
I mean, you know? But it's, there's other reasons too. But so, I mean, it makes sense though, because you could either go on one sheep hunt. You know, if you just want to weigh out the economics of it, how many elk hunts could you go on for that same sheep hunt? You know what I mean? And you can't logistically do all those elk hunts, so you can do one quarter of them, and you get to hunt every day for the rest of your life. You know what I'm? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, if you find something you love to do, just go pursue that, especially if it's that much cheaper. You know, that's kind of what the elk thing is it really is kind of the poor man's way to really go on a good mountain hunt and go experience that thing, you know? I mean, you can't go chase them at 14, I don't think, and I'm okay with that. But otherwise, you know, it's just pretty much hard to beat elk hunting for what all I've done. Do you feel?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've hunted mule deer and, you know, pronghorns and that kind of stuff. I mean,
yeah.
Do you feel like elk is kind of the epitome of hunting for you?
Well, you know, possibly. I mean, I've really gotten into mule deer hunting, kind of again. I got into it pretty heavy in the early 2000s and got pretty obsessive over finding big mule deer. And I was in a lot better shape, and you know, it was super fun. And then as my boys got a little older, I kind of had to pull the reins in a little bit. And you know, with a mule deer hunter, you've really got to dedicate some time if you're going to look for a good deer. You know,
yeah.
And I just couldn't do those extended trips like I used to do. So, but now, you know, and so I elk hunted a lot, quick trips in and out. I did a lot of, I would say in the early 2000s up until probably about 2012 or 13, I did a lot of, like hunts that I'd never done much before, like moose hunts and caribou hunts and things like that, that, you know, you go through an outfitter somewhere up in Canada or somewhere, and, you know, you have a certain amount of time and it's scheduled. And those kind of hunts fit more into my life plan, I guess, if you will.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I could set up a time and set the business around it and make sure I wasn't missing something important as far as like a milestone in the kids' lives or, but now that they're, you know, grown and doing their thing, you know, I'm back to, you know, I spent 16 days in New Mexico last year.
Yeah, you were there before we got there and after we left.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, purposely didn't answer your phone call on the way out of the state, you know? So, like, we know you're there a long time.
I know. Y'all didn't answer the phone because I needed help packing a bull out by myself. Yeah. And y'all were like, oh, we have no service. We have no service. Of course, y'all are posting selfies of each other every 15 seconds.
Well, that was an oxymoron, Brian. You can't post a selfie of each other. Then it's not a selfie anymore.
Yeah. Your old cripple buddy's trying to pack an elk out by himself, yeah. And you guys are, you know, taking selfies and flipping your hair for Instagram.
We're sorry. Listen, if we tag out early, we're coming down to call for you and just pack all your animals this year, all right? Be ready.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's because y'all can just come cook.
Go come cook. Hey, I'd be down.
Yeah.
I bring a lot. I meant to give you some peppers the other day, and I forgot to do that. But did you ever eat that salsa? I hadn't heard anything. You must not liked it.
Oh, we wiped that out in about 30 minutes. That stuff was fantastic.
Good, man. I'm glad you liked it. It's like a half pint or something like that. You know, it's pretty small, but makes for a good little roadie. So glad you liked it.
Yeah.
So just realistically, how many bulls have you killed?
Man. There is no upside to answering a question like that.
Yeah. Come on, man. I mean, I really am curious.
Only a downside.
Well, huh? give me a high and a low. Over under 30.
No, I hadn't killed that many.
Okay.
I've killed more than 10, less than 20.
Okay. So you've killed more than most people that I've ever talked to. And I'm guessing from, you know, Idaho all the way down to New Mexico, right?
And then, and now I have shot quite a few cows. I am a
now these
sucker.
Are cow elk, right?
That's true. You got, with you, you got to differentiate.
Yeah, my bad. Yeah, cow elk. I'm a sucker for elk meat. So when I start getting down to the wire, I'm definitely not a trophy hunter. You know, it's funny. I've hunted probably, arguably, one of the best elk units in the country. Three times, and hunted some of the better ones around it, you know, two or three times. And I never went into those hunts with the intentions of passing on anything. I didn't go in there like I'm going in for a 350 bull.
Well, it's like you said back then, that knowledge wasn't quite as ready for everyone as it is now, right? I mean, you probably, you knew that those units were great, but like you probably didn't really know that, hey, this year it's a 370 plus unit, you know, because the moisture's good and stuff like that. You know, just I'm sure it was different.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, what's funny is I still don't really pay attention to it. But I mean, I've gotten lucky in there that the first bulls by have been like, you know, 360, 370, you know, bulls and a bunch of 350s. And it's just luck because if a 250 would have came by first, I mean, that's what would have got. I mean, I shot a 280 bull last year, you know, in a premier unit.
You know, you say that, but for your average elk hunter, a 280 is a big bull, man. I know that
it's got to be
numbers,
like a 135 whitetail, doesn't
it? Yeah. I mean, a 275 or 270 is a Pope and Young.
I thought it was 260 was Pope and Young.
Nah, I don't think so. I don't know. I might be wrong there. But
I'll check.
Like, I have no idea.
A 280 is like, that's a decent 6 point normally, you know, or maybe a really big five. Either way, like if you go to like an OTC unit, that's a trophy pulling that thing off the mountain, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
elk hunting's a weird thing where these big numbers get thrown around a lot, and whitetail's starting to get there too. But you know, elk it gets exponential real quick.
260,
hot dog. But
well, the guy that we had calling and filming last year, you know, he's done a lot of elk hunting.
Yeah,
and but he's younger, like you guys, and you know, we're glassing up bulls, and man, there were these two bulls that kept hanging in this one little bowl every day, and they were probably like 200 inch bulls. And every day he had to talk me out of going over there and getting one of them jokers.
Let's do it.
I mean, they were halfway down the mountain. They were bedding in the same little bowl every day, right off this flat creek bed, that I could have walked that meat downhill out of flat creek bed about a mile to a road. I'm like, I'm all over that. That's a trophy to me, is how easy is it going to be for me to get it out of there?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, he kept talking me off the ledge of going and doing it. And I was like, man, I just don't care.
Yeah.
I love eating them. I love having them close. I love everything about them. I love the way they smell, all the sounds. I like everything about them, but I don't really care how big they are. And I don't know how I'm ever going to get to a point in my life like that. Cause I mean, if I come home from an elk hunt and don't have a cooler slap full of elk meat, I'm going to be in the penalty box when I get home.
Yeah, I was last year. Don't worry. I understand.
Dude, I know a guy that won't go elk hunting because he says it's way too much work. He's a mule deer hunting fool, man. That's what he wants to do.
Because you can put the whole thing on your back and go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a big old dude, you know, but he's like, I'm just not into doing the elk things. Too much work.
Mm.
So.
Well, it's a lot of work. I mean, that's probably what I love the most about it. You know what? I'm not in the same physical condition and the abilities that I was for most of my elk hunting career. And, you know, and that's one thing that I think, instead of doing all this BS, and that people probably would love to hear, is how to come from the east, you know, to a Western hunt and be efficient. And one of the things I would say is that, you know, after I had, you know, I had a building collapse on me in 2013 and couldn't walk for a long time and had to really work hard at building myself back up after that. And one of the things that I learned after that is, and I guess I always did it to a degree, being an Eastern guy coming west, is that, you know, the straight line is not always the best path when you're elk hunting or hunting in the mountains. And so, you know, I plan my paths based on elevation and the amount of gain and loss. And so I know now that it, while most guys that live out west have the ability to just to go in a straight line, guys like us that don't live in that environment and our bodies are not acclimated to handling the climbs and the, you know, descents, the thin air, we have to approach things a little different. So I do a lot of side hilling. I do a lot of ridge top walking. I may walk around a bowl on the ridge, and it may be a mile longer, and it may take me an hour longer to do it. But if I try to drop in a basin and go straight up the other side, the next day, my legs are completely frogged out and I'm worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so, you know, trying to listen to all these Western podcasts about how they do these things and, you know, how far they're walking in and packing into these wilderness areas, we can't do that if we don't live out there. We don't go out there and you know, prepare our bodies for it by physically doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big difference. And so I think that's super important, is to have people understand how to read topo maps and understand that if you'll stay on these elevation lines and side hill more than up and down, you're going to be stronger longer. You're going to be able to do what you need to do for 7 days instead of burning out the first two and then losing day three and four trying to recover and then getting yourself back going again. You know, you've got to preserve your body. So that's one thing I think is super important.
Let's expand on that a little bit and kind of send it into the hunting strategy, because I get what you're saying, and, you know, following an elevation line, you know, bar none, is the way to save your legs. So if you got weight on your back, for sure. But it's hard to do that and actually hunt elk effectively, because elk move up and down these elevation lines. So how do you mix that into your hunting strategy, you know, walking ridge tops and that sort of thing?
Well, I hear what you're saying, but elk are usually coming up during the day,
mm-hmm.
and they're usually dropping down in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually pushing up into a little basin or a canyon or a draw during the day, and then they're usually coming out. Once you figure out what these elk are doing, you know, you want to try to start at the elevation that you think you're going to be hunting these bulls. So, like, my philosophy is dropping elevation is the last resort. I mean, it is everything before you decide to drop elevation. I don't drop unless I have to. And if I do drop elevation and I'm going to go way down somewhere, I'm going down because I know I'm going to go there and kill one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't just go walking to be walking. I don't go down there to look and see where they went, see what they're doing. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know where they're going, know where they're coming out, you know, and it's a strategy thing. I mean, there's been many a bulls that I've killed that I've seen literally within the first 15 or 20 minutes of daylight disappearing. And then once they've disappeared, I've moved to a point that I am pretty sure is going to be somewhere they're going to come out in the evening. And I literally will sit there all day and wait for that. And the other thing that the Western guys are really obsessive about is the thermals,
mm-hmm.
and how the thermals will change, and they'll, you know, bring your scent up and down based on the thermals. And it's, you know, basically cold air is heavy and warm air is light. It's an easy way to think of it. So as the day warms up, the thermals start pulling uphill, and vice versa when it's cooling down. But it seems like most Western guys that I've hunted with, it's it's all thermals. It's all or nothing thermals. It's, you know, that's all they're hunting. And they almost seem to forget that there's a wind direction too. And so, and this is kind of the same way that I whitetail hunt. I'm never a downwind guy. Like, I don't set up downwind. Mm-hmm. I set up parallel winds. Because mm-hmm. if you're setting up downwind, you're setting up where the animals are coming from. So with regards to Western hunting and thermals, you know, guys are setting up for the, you know, the rise and the fall, basically, of those thermals. But they're really discrediting or discounting the fact that you've got a hard west wind or an east wind or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. In relationship to those thermals, it's not going to go straight up and straight down. So yes, while you may have, you know, elk bedded up this canyon on this northwest facing slope, you know, if you've got a wind that's blowing, you know, basically across that canyon, and you've got thermals while your scent may be going up that draw they're in, the wind is going to be pulling it to the other side. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things you want to do is, you know, still play the wind and set up to where you think these animals are going to be, stay back. And then once you start hearing a move, because you're going to hear them, they make so much noise. Once they start to move, then you, as they get closer, you can start getting closer to this ambush point. But you basically using a parallel wind, if you will. The thermals may be going up towards where they're going, but the wind is drifting it off to the other side of the canyon or the basin.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, and that's super important. And that's, you know, I feel like all Eastern guys seem to do a little better job at that than the Western guys do, because we're usually just wind, you know, predominant wind factor, not thermals. But mm-hmm. You know, and then the other thing is the craze of, you know, the $800 backpack and the $400 boots and the 2-pound tent and cutting ounces and all this jazz to get down to a, you know, 40, 50 pound pack and then go 7-8 miles into a wilderness area. For an Eastern guy, for the majority of Eastern guys, that's the kiss of death.
Yeah. Oh, we did it last year and, did it, but it was terrible. You know, and we had camera gear and stuff too, so we had very heavy packs, but, you know, we worked out real hard last summer. But, you know, looking back, it's like, man, without pack animals, like, don't subject yourself to something that stupid. You know, it's just, it ain't worth it.
No, and I mean, the thing is that you can't control the weather. Mm-hmm. And if you're back there 6 or 7 miles and you shoot a bull and it's 80 degrees, you're going to lose a lot of meat, if not all of it. Mm-hmm. You physically can't get it out. So, you know, my recommendation is if you want to do a wilderness hunt, that's great. You better have a packer lined up.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be your number one priority, is finding a packer and have somebody reliable that's going to answer the phone.
Hey, expand on what a packer is just a little bit.
Well, just somebody that's got a pack string, you know, of horses and mules. Uh-huh. Somebody that's going to come in there and, you know, a lot of these guys, you can pay them $500 or $1,000 to take you in and bring you out. And then if you're going to walk in, that's fine. But you can have something set up with them where they'll, you know, for $500, they'll bring up, you know, a couple of mules and a couple of horses in there and get all your crap, load your elk up and haul it out of there. You know, that's honestly, truthfully, that's really the only way that most Eastern guys can do it effectively. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've always done a kind of a mix of that style hunting. I've done a lot of wilderness hunting in certain units that I know are really good. But when I do that, I'm 100% utilizing a packer's services. And then, but the other side of my hunting for elk has been, you know, park at a trailhead or side of the road and you're hunting elk within a mile and a half, two at the most from the pickup.
Yeah.
And you're coming out.
That's what most of mine has been too. It all, except for last year, it's always been truck camping. And then you wake up early in the morning and drive to your, you know, hunting area for the day, or at least the morning, you know, and then if you're, if you've got some legs under you and you can make it a little ways off in there, you know, you're getting past the ATV guys and stuff, it's pretty effective, or can be, you know.
I mean, I've killed more bulls hunting, you know, day hunting from a pickup than I have on wilderness hunts. Mm-hmm. And I would say that my wilderness hunts to pickup hunts are probably commensurate with each other as far as the number of hunts. Mm-hmm. That way. And I've been definitely more successful. And the thing is that you're more mobile. You know, an elk can cover 5 miles, you know, in the time for you to go, crap, I bumped them, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if you're strictly restricted to foot travel, you can't do that. You go into a wilderness area, and even if you do use a packer and you go get dropped in, and if you're there 2 or 3 days and there's no fresh elk sign, you got to pop smoke and get out of there.
Yeah.
But guys will just go sit in these places where people drop them or where they've hiked into, and they're pot committed on one spot, and that's never going to work for elk. You've got to be extremely mobile and, you know, have all of these different plans in place, you know, 3, 4, 5 plans to where, you know, you just keep moving until you get in them.
Yeah.
And that's really the only way to do it. And it's only because an elk can move so far, so fast, it's nothing to them. Yeah. You know, they may find something sweeter in one basin that's 2 miles away than where you are. And if you don't have the ability to relocate, you'll never know that you're close, but not close enough, you know?
Mm-hmm. Hey, something that people don't talk about very often, and I've always kind of wondered, is people talk about getting into the elk, and you know when you're in them, and, you know, oh, you know, we found them, we're in there. There's got to be some sort of an art to hunting elk for 4 or 5 days and not bumping that herd out and sending them on their way. Do you feel like it's always just a ticking time bomb, or is there really something strategic that you can do to make sure that you just stay on the same herd and, you know, don't bump them 2 drainages over?
Well, that has a lot. There's a lot of variables there. That's a super subjective question, because
that's what we ask on podcasts. You know, if we ask cut and dry questions, you get short answers.
Okay.
But, you know.
Well, yeah. So one answer to that is yes. If you plan on being in one spot and you don't have the ability to relocate, you really need to let the elk come to you. You don't want to push up into the dark timber where they're bedding, or, you know, during the day. Mm-hmm. And that's super important. But if you have the ability to be mobile and you have a short window to hunt, I mean, you don't have the luxury of sitting back and waiting for them to come to you and get that perfect ambush. So, you know, that's super important, is to kind of know what your different scenario is. Mm-hmm.
How do you set up camp to that? I think that's really what I'm getting at. Like, mm-hmm. you know, say, for instance, let's just take our situation, because, I mean, I'm being selfish with the question.
Yeah.
You know where we're going this year. It's a place that you kind of pointed us to.
Yeah.
We're putting some trust in you. You didn't lead us astray last year. You know, I've gotten some honey holes. But
listen, you can tell the people it's in New Jersey. I've killed a lot of bulls
there.
Yeah,
man, and seek a deer up there. But
salt flat.
Yeah, salt flats. But, you know, I've always done the truck thing, pretty much, you know, and you're definitely nowhere near the elk that you're hunting. Well, if you go in with stuff on your back and you go in a few miles or whatever it is, you want to set up where they're within striking distance, but you also want to set up to where you're not bumping elk that are, you know, rut fest in your camp all night. You know what I mean? So how do you figure that out?
If you're not prepared to walk a mile every morning, don't go elk hunting.
Mm-hmm.
There's really nothing else to say. If you're going to let laziness push you to where you're going to camp, where you can hear them from your tent and you're right in the middle of them, just don't go elk hunting. Just keep whitetail hunting. You want to be close to them, but a mile is close.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be a mile in a direction you know they're not coming in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you want them going away from you at night. So wherever you start in the morning, they're coming back to you. Does that make sense?
So yes. what are some examples of terrain or habitat that you could assume they would not be going towards at night?
Well, basically where a lot of other people are camping.
Okay.
Main roads, things of that nature. I mean, it's, you know, there's lots of places they're going to go. If you're basically setting up on a ridge line at daylight and you're looking down into a basin or multiple basins, because you know that's where elk are going at night, odds are that they're going down to where there's feed and water. Well, if there's no water on the other side of that ridge, that's where you want to camp. They're not going to walk 10 miles across somewhere there's no water when there's water a mile on the other side of the ridge.
Gotcha.
And those are, that's, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but in there lies the problem. Being humans, we also require H2O, you know. So I guess you have to find a way to balance your need for water with where the elk are.
Yeah, again, if you're talking about backpack hunting, yeah, I mean, there's a difference in how we source water versus an elk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all we need is a trickle.
Yeah.
You know.
When you're talking elk waters, you're talking about tanks and big streams.
Yeah, they're wanting to go do, half gainers and, you know.
Yeah, hey, on that deal, I've seen, evidence of elk using water quite a bit. You never really see them tearing up streams too much. You know, have you seen elk water out of a stream, or is it always still water?
No, I've seen them water out of streams, and it was, so one of the places I showed you guys, kind of that northwest portion up there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a canyon and a stream that runs up one of those valleys there, and it's live water. It's not like a big creek, but it's just a pretty steady little trickle. And some years I've gone up that drainage and elk have made wallows in the creek three or four times, three or four different wallows going up that creek.
Hmm.
And then some years, nothing. It's the weirdest thing. It's, you just never know, but I don't know. They seem to like, I mean, I know they'll definitely drink out of live water, but
yeah.
They seem to like those tanks. And I think the tanks are a social aspect as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're, they're bailing off of that thing and flopping around and slinging mud and having a big time. I mean, mm-hmm. Same stuff you do in the summer.
Yeah. Water around in mud,
That's it.
So, earlier you were kind of talking about the Westie's strategy versus like what an Eastern guy does. Another thing you see with some of the big popular YouTube guys is put camp on your back and go, and wherever you end up, stop. That seems super counterintuitive to me, but I'm no Westie. So do you, when you're talking about if you're doing a backpack thing, are you 100% of the time having like a base camp you go back to every evening?
Well, I do now.
Yeah.
But I used to not do that. But so let's say that if you're going to do that, it's super effective, but what you've got to do is...
Which one's super effective?
Having your camp on your back.
Okay.
No, I that used to be, I love to hunt that way. I just can't physically do it anymore.
Yeah.
So, but if you're going to do it, this is what's super important. You want to parallel, you basically want to create a triangle, okay? And your pickup is the point of your triangle. So you want to, basically angle away, and you want to say, find a trailhead or a parking spot to where you're in the center of a range that you're going to hunt. Okay. So let's say that the flat side of that triangle opposite of the point is going to be a huge ridge that's running north and south. It's, a series of mountains and ridges, that range is going to run, up and down below tree line. And you've got basically all of this hunting between where you've parked and in that range. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you basically want to angle south and intersect it, climb up. And you want to basically parallel where you're hunting and work your way north or south, and then be able to, triangulate back to your truck. So you're paralleling where you parked. So what you're doing is you're hunting between those areas. You don't want to just take a path away from your truck and just start walking away. Because then what are you going to do if you whack one, 10 miles away? It makes zero sense. You've got to have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
of what you're doing and where you park your vehicle is just as important as part of that plan as to where that you're going to find elk possibly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is a super effective way, you know, to do it. And it, of course, used to be a big part of my arsenal. It's just not anymore.
Yeah.
But the good thing is, you know, I'm not hunting the same places I used to hunt, mm-hmm. you know, I'm hunting places that are more road accessible now, you know,
to make that feasible. Are you kind of planning for 3-day loops? That way you don't have to have a ton of stuff on your back.
Well, I did just because of my, you know, being from the East and physical limitations, there's mm-hmm. guys that can do as much as you want to carry.
Yeah.
But for me, that's kind of what it was. It was a 3-day comfortable loop, 4-day if you got in them, and you're just going to tough it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a super effective way to hunt. But again, at no time was I ever more than 3 or 4 miles from the truck. So, you know, by design, once I kind of figured out what I was doing.
Yeah.
The early days, I did some pretty bonehead crap, mm-hmm. You know, and I'd follow elk. And then at that point, figure out, you know, how to get back.
Yeah.
I didn't really care back then.
Well, you know? That's when you find somebody down in town to drive you around 60 miles and take you back.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, I've done that many times.
Gosh.
I mean, and hell, half the time I didn't even know how to tell them where to go, where I was left my truck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know? So,
you're down in Chihuahua, and you're like, I need to get back to Del Rio, guys. How do you, you know, yeah. how do you get there?
Yeah, but no, that is a super effective way to do it, but you've got to, you know, create kind of a triangle and parallel with the where the point is, where your truck is.
So you know, something I do when I look at maps, I want you to tell me if I'm dumb or, well, in relation to this, you've already told me I'm dumb.
Okay. But,
I've got this thing in my head that north-facing slopes are the place. So when I look at maps, I just kind of ride off south-facing, you know, big mountain ranges. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I always just think that the north side of that range is where the elk are, and on the south side, it's just going to be not good hunting. Is that effective, or am I shooting myself in the foot because a lot of guys are thinking the same thing, and the elk, by pressure, get pushed to the south side?
Man, again, that's incredibly subjective.
I like long answers, Brian. Come on.
Okay. So with regards to the north-facing slopes, it's really, you know, that's really going to kind of coincide with where you're hunting and what type of country it is. So like the area I was hunting in last year, there's not a lot of like super deep, you know, super deep canyons and dark, you know, tall timber for them to jump into and get in that cool timber. So, I mean, like those two little raghorns that I wanted to get so bad this past year, you know, they were literally, you know, bedding on a straight south facing slope every day, just out in the wide open, and they'd move around and get under a couple little trees, get them some shade, but they didn't really have, you know, those elk just didn't have those places to go. But you get over to where you guys were hunting, and there's some pretty good topography there, and there's some pretty good little draws that they can get up in. And I marked some of them for you guys where I've seen them going in bed. And my gosh, when you get into a really good northwest facing, you know, steep slope that's got good timber on it, I mean, you can feel the temperature drop 10, 12 degrees when you come around, you know, come around the mountain and you ease into those areas. It is noticeably cooler. You know, that's where you'd want to hang meat if you had a bull down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, once you learn to identify these places in certain areas, man, that's a home run. In other areas, it just doesn't matter. I'd say that the starting point for me is always going to be, you know, peg all the water. you want to peg all the water everywhere around. You want to peg it, and you want to basically X out all these areas that just don't have good water sources on them. And then from that, you want to kind of go in and say, okay, are there any really deep canyons that have some really steep, good timbered, you know, northwest facing slopes on them that, you know, these elk are going to push up into? And, you know, if you've got a half dozen spots like that pinned, and then you've got some water pinned, if there's elk there, you're going to figure out super quick where they're coming and going from. You know, these things are not rabbits. They're not, they can't hide very easy.
Yeah.
You know, so even if it's super thick timber, they're going to leave a lot of sign. You're going to smell them like crazy, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of how I do it, is water first, then cover, and then try to figure out the to and from and when they're doing it.
Gotcha.
And that's it.
Okay, you know? So let me ask you this. You're not, from what I understand, you're not necessarily a big caller. You like to get between the elk and kind of just, you know, assassinate them as they walk by. but there's a lot of guys that are trying to call elk in, especially in September, right? And yeah. You're the heavy arrow guy. How do you shoot a frontal shot? Have you ever shot one? And what's the best way to do that?
Frontal shot to me is probably, if not the best, one of the best shots on an elk if you've got the right setup. And by the right setup, I mean you got a, you know, properly tuned bow. You got great arrow flight. You've got a super durable, you know, head, cut on contact head, and a heavy arrow, because you can make the frontal shot without that. It's just a lot smaller window to thread through. And if you mess up a little bit, you still want to have those other things in your favor to help you get on through. I'll tell you that, you know, I like, basically, if you're looking at an elk facing you, if you could pick center, like the center of his chest, top to bottom, and then just shift right or left, depending on which angle he's facing you. That is the shot I like to take. Now, a lot of that's going to depend on the animal's elevation in relationship to you. So, you know, if he's below you, you want to have a higher point of impact. If he's above you, you want to have a lower point of impact. What you're trying to do is you're not trying to shoot him in the heart. You're trying to shoot the top of the arteries off the heart,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where all those big vessels are coming out of the lungs, dropping into the top of the heart. And if you can do that and shoot through those, you know, big arteries that are going into the top of the heart and then go through the lungs, I mean, I've never had a frontal run out of sight. Mm. I've never had a frontal shot bull leave my sight.
Wow.
So it's so super effective. But again, I don't call now the way I probably used to. You know, I think we've established 29 years ago when I thought it was 19. but I don't probably. Yeah, I probably don't call as much as I used to, which I know is kind of counterintuitive because calling's gotten so popular, but that's probably why I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, I mean, all I hear whenever I'm hunting is just guys blowing on their horns.
Yeah.
And that's all the elk hear, you know? And so again, that's going to be dependent on where you're hunting. Some areas you could get away with it. And, you know, we did a lot of calling last year because the guys I hunted with loved to call, and it was super effective. I mean, we called a bunch of bulls in and all, but man, for me, if I would have been by myself, it wouldn't have lasted very long.
Well, once you're by yourself, it didn't last very long. That's why we left, you know, we knew you were about to kill.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm not saying they were. I didn't want it to come across that way. I know.
Your strategy been different.
It was different, yeah. Because I mean, like, there were many times where I saw bulls, you know, go into a certain area, and I felt, man, I can get in there and kill that bull. But instead, we were setting up and calling. And sometimes we called them out, and sometimes we didn't. And sometimes other bulls came that we never had no clue they were there. But that's a special place. You know, that's a place that you're going to have opportunities to call bulls in. For the most part, where most guys that are listening to this are going to go, you know, you're not going to have the success blowing on those horns like these guys do.
Unless you're willing to cover a crap ton of country and find that one bull. But, you know, why do you want to walk past 10 to find one?
Yeah. And it's all dependent. I mean, if you're in super thick cover and you can't glass and you can't find them, man, you really don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I choose not to hunt those places, you know?
Yeah.
But if you find yourself there, I mean, you pretty much got to do it. But anymore, really, what I do more than anything is probably roll rocks and rake trees. That's my calling strategy. I love it.
Sounds like fun, too, you know? It's well, like just cavemaning out in the middle of mountains, you know?
Like a strongman contest, you know, rolling those, you know, 80 stone boulders or whatever it is. But
did you just weigh something in stones? What?
Have you never watched those strongman contests?
Yeah, but I mean, come on.
Okay. Read a book, dude. So
you just referenced watching TV, so I don't know.
Yeah. So I did, didn't I? ESPN the Ocho, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So no, I mean, that's really been super effective is raking trees and you know, rolling rocks and stuff to make this, you know, sounds that are typical of what the elk are doing. They're kind of bebopping along. And then cow calling to me is super effective as long as it's not overdone.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a
real
lot
quick
of,
talk about overdone. Of, like, is that like a lot of times, or is that like, you know, when you go to make a sequence, you hit like four or five as opposed to hitting one or two?
Both. Yes. So like there's a lot of these hyper estrus thingy doodles that people are doing and the, you know, these crazy cow calling sequences, and they can 100% work. I mean, I've heard all of those things in some of the most heavily pressured Colorado public land that you could possibly imagine. I've heard these elk do these estrus balls and all this different stuff, but it's 1 out of 100 days. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It can happen, but more often than not, it's a chirp, and then it's a little cow chirp, and then, I mean, then a calf chirp. I mean, it's, you know, a couple of cows and a calf or something that are just very faintly communicating each other as they're, you know, working through an area at feeding or whatever. That's what you hear more than anything. You know, you hear these bulls bugle all night long, and as soon as the sun starts to crack, it gets less and less, and it's pretty much quiet, you know. So for you to be, you know, blowing bugles at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, it's just not what they're doing.
Mm.
You know, in most of these places that guys are going to hunt public land. So, and that does bring up another point. I spend a lot of time at night up and on my feet. Because if you're really struggling to find elk, if they are going to be vocal, they're going to be doing it at night. And, you know, if you can get a west wind and you can get up high and walk a ridge one night and just walk north or south and just listen to the west, if you think there's elk down there and there's water, that wind and that, you know, night air is going to carry those bugles. You're going to be able to hear those elk. And so while you may not be in them, if you spend time at night covering ground, you can find them. At least find out where they are. Mm-hmm. Where you can pick up and move and get to where the elk are, because, you know, if you're in a spot and there's not elk there, there's not fresh sign, you're just rolling the dice and just praying and hoping that somebody else is going to push elk to you. And that's not being an effective elk hunter.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time, or used to spend a lot of time at night, you know, covering ground. I'm trying to give, you know, insight from experiences from the, you know, longer ago than what I do currently, because I'm hunting different places now. I'm not hunting places that, you know, I really have to work as hard as I used to.
Yeah.
And that's just the natural progression of a hunter, you know, but those times back then, like, where I sent y'all in there last year, that trail that would run basically straight west of where y'all had those encounters,
mm-hmm.
you know, that trail kind of popped up on that ridge and it was west of where y'all were. And then yep. it kind of went off to the northwest. There were many nights that I would walk, you know, 2, 3, 4 miles headed up to the northwest, back up towards the road, kind of walking that trail, listening, trying to figure out where the elk were at night, you know, and then just marking it. Mm-hmm. And then figuring out how to, you know, get up there the next day and set up and figure out where they're coming and going.
Yeah.
And
okay, so explain that strategy a little bit. Are you leaving camp, walking around real light, and then going back to camp and getting in bed?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not ever going to set up camp in the dark. Yeah, that's something I don't ever want to do. That's a last resort.
It's not that you're getting up early and going and finding them and staying on them. You're actually sleeping in two shifts that night.
Well, so if I'm not on elk, I'm not going to be scouting during the middle of the day,
because
mm-hmm. they're not moving. They're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I sleep during the middle of the day. And so, you know, if I'm going to relocate, you know, I'll pack up that afternoon after I've slept, you know, till 2 or 3 o'clock, pack things up and start working a new direction and get set up before dark, have dinner. And then when it gets dark, say, okay, I'm going to walk 3 miles up this trail and I'm going to turn and come back. And there's been times where I've walked for hours up a trail, didn't hear anything. And on the way back, heard them.
Mm-hmm.
They decided to fire up at, you know, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, whatever. So,
do you ever play your flute at night like that to see if you can, you know, pop one off?
Yeah, I don't have a problem blowing a bugle at night, especially if the elk are naturally already doing it, you know?
Yeah.
But what I don't want to do is blow a bugle from my camp.
Yeah.
I don't want to have elk come to where I'm camped, you know, looking for what they've heard. And there's been many times where I've set up camp in the blind, you know, right before dark, and then taken a walk and then come back. And when I get back to camp, there's elk all around my camp. I just didn't know, you know?
Yeah.
You don't know. I mean, you're not going to get it right every time.
Yeah.
You're going to screw up.
Let me ask you this. You're talking to a guy who doesn't sleep well sometimes. Do you take like Tylenol PM or anything like that in there with you to help you sleep in the middle of the day, or Benadryl or something like that?
Man, I'll be honest with you. I don't sleep at all. Like when I'm at home, it sleep is just not part of my life. It sucks. But it's just how I'm built. When I get out there, and Lord willing, I have no cell service, which is, you know, my dream scenario. When I get out there, I am so relaxed. I just don't have trouble sleeping. And then, you know, if I want to lay down on a hillside with the sun on my face, I can do it. I can sleep.
I've struggled on the midday naps, man.
Oh, not me, man. I love it. It's probably where I sleep the best is in a tree stand when the sun hits me, or on the side of a hill.
I have never fallen asleep in a tree stand.
Oh man, I've taken some good naps in a tree stand.
Oh, I've taken some great dives. Been asleep halfway to the bottom. But I guarantee you, I sleep hard enough on the side of those mountains that I could be half eaten by a bear before I woke up. I mean, it's that bad. If you're in elk, I mean, there's no reason to be pushing them out of where you're at if you've got plenty of days to hunt them. And so there's no reason to force the issue. So sleep during the middle of the day, you know, hunt your prime times. If you're not in them, you know, cover some ground at night. I'm telling you, man, the night thing, if I had to say there was one thing that has led to killing bulls consistently, is covering ground at night and finding where the elk are. Because that's, I mean, once you find them, they're not like the hardest things in the world to get within bow range of.
Mm-hmm. So, you know? Well, okay, let's take that and convert it into killing one. You find them at night, and your move is, okay, I'm going to find what's up from there and go get in that spot.
Well, you know, it's just like whitetail hunting. And I think this is where Eastern guys have an advantage, okay? So it's just like whitetail hunting. So you're sitting on a ridge. You know that you're hearing elk bugle a mile, say, west of you. And you're looking on your map and you're going, oh, my gosh, there's a big tank down there in a meadow above it. Well, you can look at your map. And just like whitetails, you're like, okay, well, I've seen this deer here twice. Well, I know for sure he's not bedding in the middle of that cow pasture, so I can mark that off. Well, I know for sure he's not bedding over here. There's no cover, so I can mark that off. So you basically are eliminating, you know, all these places that you know that they really can't go during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing with elk. You're like, okay, well, they're down there at that water now. They're in that meadow. Now you start doing your process of elimination. You know, you're eliminating the places that they can't go, and then just leaving you with the options that they can. You know, and that's going to be, I'm a little distracted. There's this tree frog, and he is straight wrecking some flies on my window here.
That's cool.
So you're eliminating the places that you know they can't go, and that's going to leave your options. And if you're sitting up there when the sun comes up, odds are you're going to see them going back into where they're going. And then once you see that, you know, you've got an idea of what they're doing. And so
how often do you kill them the next morning as opposed to that evening?
Very rarely the next morning, because you really don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the
key is to put eyes on them. Is that the thing? See, I've never hunted where I see the elk first. I always hear them or smell them and then figure it out from there. And it sounds like you're really putting eyes on where they're headed a lot of times.
Well, I may not be putting eyes on them. What I may be doing is hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be too dense for me not to see them. But if I can hear them at daylight going up in a canyon, I know where they're going, you know? I mean, it's just the process of elimination. It's so rare that you're going to kill one in the morning getting ahead of them the first time, because they walk at the rate we trot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we jog at the speed they feed. You're not going to catch them and get ahead of them. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But in the evenings, you know where they're headed, where you think you know where they're headed. They can always, of course, fool you and just pop out the top of a canyon and go straight up a cliff and up and over, and they're out of your life. That happens more often than not, but but you know what I'm saying. I mean, you have an idea that, hey, if they do the same thing they did last night, then they got to come down through here. And I remember the one of the biggest bulls I've ever killed. I've never actually had him scored, but I know he's probably close to 380, and that was a New Mexico bull that would have been in 1994 or five. I can't remember, but I was, struggling. I mean, I'd struggled for the first 4 or 5 days and hadn't really gotten on the elk, you know, and, which super frustrating. So, I picked out these two, tanks that I had walked by during the day and could tell there was some fresh elk activity around them, but didn't really know where they were coming from, you know, couldn't figure it out. A lot of options, you know. So I, you know, ate dinner that night, and then I hopped in the truck and I rode about, you know, 4 or 5 miles down to where these areas were. And I parked and I walked out through these meadows in the middle of the night, And man, they were there. I mean, the elk were in those meadows, and I just stayed downwind and just kind of sat with them all night and dozed off and, you know, just kind of stayed there all night and just kind of shadowed them. And then as the sun started to come up, you know, they were already out of that big meadow. And this meadow was probably, you know, gosh, it was probably 2 miles wide, maybe 3 or 4 miles long. It was big. Mm-hmm. But I figured out where they were going, and they went up into this canyon that I never would have dreamed just wasn't anything that really would stand out to you is where they were headed. But what they were doing is they were going up this little slight draw, and then they were popping over the backside into this just nothing little canyon that was just this perfect little hidey hole. And so that afternoon, you know, I set up, and they did exactly what they were supposed to do.
Set up in the canyon?
I set up in the little draw, you know, that they were using to go in and out.
Uh-huh.
And I set up in there, and, you know, I waited until, you know, it was temperature dropping and the thermals were starting to pull down the canyon before I eased up in there. So, I mean, you know, you're talking about 7 o'clock at night. You know, it's getting dark at, what, 8:30 or so?
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about 7 o'clock at night, not even going and getting into position. Ooh, until then.
That feels scary.
Yeah, it does.
Well, you know, but you got to realize, I mean, you go up in there at 5 and the thermals are still going up that draw, you know, you've uh-huh. burned it.
Yeah.
They're not coming sense. Down it. So you're just sitting there waiting and then, you know, coming around the point and going up in there. And so this went on for 7 days. For 7 days, I only afternoon hunted them.
Mm.
And for 7 days, that bull brought this herd of cows and small bulls down this draw, and he picked a different trail. And so I'd be on one side and they'd come down the other and vice versa. So on the 7th day, I finally killed him. But it was 7 days straight of the elk doing the exact same thing, and I couldn't kill him.
Man.
So you're just allowing the thermal to take your wind away from the one trail on one side or another of a canyon like that, and just waiting.
That's
and
right.
You're letting how many elk?
You have to play it. Yeah.
The elk are just walking by you until all of a sudden there's a giant bull and you just broadside him right there.
Oh yeah. And this guy was, you know, this bull was screaming. He was screaming coming out every night in the last 30 minutes before dark.
Man.
And that's the only time he'd make a sound. He wouldn't make a peep. But the last 30 minutes, it was like low, low light. He'd start screaming. And so based on what the wind was doing and the thermals, I'd get on this side of the canyon or that side of the canyon. There was many a time where I was like, man, I really want to hunt that trail, but I just can't do it. I'm going to burn it. And every evening they came out and they would be, you know, 100, 150 yards on the other side from here, this or that. And then finally, I got it to where it was just coming straight down the draw the 7th day. And I put my butt slap dab right in the middle of the middle trail. But I was 50 to one trail and about 75 to the other. But I knew if they came down the other, I would know soon enough and I could work my way closer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they came down that 50 trail, you know, and I was parallel with them. And I was getting really nervous because probably about a dozen cows had passed me on that trail at 50, and they started filtering down into the bottom, like coming off the side of the hill, you know, the side of the canyon and dropping into the bottom where I was. And I knew at any minute that one of them was going to catch my scent and bark, you know, because it was just drifting right down the middle. And I guarantee I was within a minute or two of one of them catching me when the bull came down the trail. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, I had set up in there a few times and I had walked off, you know, from that trail to where I thought, you know, where I was set up at. And I walked it off at about 65 yards, but I knew on a straight line going across the canyon, an angle, it was probably only 50.
Mm-hmm.
So the day before I left, they had come way down behind me, like 150 yards, and they were already out in the pasture. And I still had good light. They were gone. I drew back and I put my 50 pin on the base of this tree on the trail. It was basically perfectly broadside to me, and 10 ringed it perfect right at the base of the tree. I had to unscrew the broadhead and leave the broadhead in the base of the tree, but I hit it perfect. So I knew that the trail was dead nuts 50. Mm-hmm. And when the bull did come down, he was raking that tree with the broadhead stuck in the bottom of it.
That's cool.
Man.
So that was a 1994 range finder.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that worked. It worked.
Taking a practice shot.
That's cool. Yeah. So how far would you say the average, when you kill a bull like that or an elk, where you're hunting them in the evening and they're coming back into meadows from bedding or back into water, how far, like, how do you know how close you can get to them and how far are they going to travel before it gets too dark to shoot most of the time?
Well, that's almost like a chess match where you're working in closer and closer every day. You know, you're not going to get lucky the first day and set up right where you need to be. You just got to kind of keep pushing in, pushing in, pushing in, you know, until you kind of find that perfect spot. And you just don't never know. You don't ever really know where that perfect spot's going to be. So, and this is strictly as it pertains to hunting bulls with cows on public land. Mm-hmm. If you're hunting places that are a low bull to cow ratio and you're seeing a lot of bulls by themselves, that's when you want to incorporate cow calls and bugles and things like that. Mostly cow calls. To me, I think that's what you've got to kind of be able to read your deck and understand what kind of hand you've been dealt. So it's all kind of a decision you've got to make based on your conditions. And then the other thing too is that, like, for morning hunts, let's say that you've got a bull and some cows working through some timber, and they're just every day they shoot straight into the timber. And then they don't get in any kind of hurry to get up where they're going to lay up during the day. And they just kind of feed and mosey through the timber and work their way up. And then they'll lay a little bit and get up and move around. When you've got that going, if you can parallel wind them with thermals in the mornings, it's been incredibly effective for me. And then as far as people I've had with me, just basically shadowing a herd, you know, staying a couple of hundred yards back from them. And just barely keeping eyes on bits and pieces of them and just kind of moving along as they go, as they're moving their way back in there. If your wind is right, you know, it's super effective, because when they get ready to start kind of parking, that bull will start circling around. He'll start circling that back last cow and kind of start pushing them up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's been super effective for me and one of the guys that I spent a lot of time hunting with. Over the years, is shadowing them in the mornings, but staying way back so you're not spooking them. And then what happens is inevitably, you know, you can see them start to slow down. You can see the bull start to push around, and you can do something as simple as, you know, break a few branches, roll a rock, do a little bit of raking. And that bull's going to circle around thinking either you're a cow that's a straggler that's gotten far back, or you're another bull slipping in. And he's just going to kind of come make a loop and look. That's been incredibly effective. And you've never really called to him. You've never disrupted him or pushed him. And maybe he comes within range. Maybe he doesn't. But if he doesn't and he goes and lays down, then you just kind of ease out, you know? Mm-hmm. And that shadowing in the morning has been super, super effective. But again, it's different places. That would be great for Colorado, but like where you guys were in New Mexico, you got a bull of cows and he's pushing up into a spot, man, you get within 100 yards from him, you can put him on blast and he's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, it just depends. I mean, it's just everything. It's not a one size fits all.
Yeah, definitely.
So is that raking the natural response? Like, if you're a satellite bull, you know, be an elk, Brian, okay? If you're a satellite bull and you're, you know, tailing up a herd with a big bull, is raking going to be something you do, you know, as a challenge to that that herd bull? Is that a thing that they do, or is it just
100%?
Okay,
100%. Yes, I would say that raking is probably the single most effective communication strategy over calling and everything else, as far as killing bulls. So last year, the last day I was there, I wanted to work my way up to the top of this mountain where I'd found this, you know, really lush, cool timbered area. And we had seen this one big bull just going in there. Every 2 or 3 days, he's pushing cows up there. And everything was happening around this mountain. That was kind of the base of operations for a lot of elk. And so, sure enough, as soon as the sun comes up, I can hear rocks tumbling, and I start looking through the timber, and I can see that same bull pushing these cows up to the top. So I'm going to go shadow him. So I get up there, and I get pretty close to him, about 800 yards, and I'm shadowing him, and he had the same group of cows, like 7 or 8 cows. And I'm shadowing along, and on the way up there, I ran into 2 different bulls that I never saw, never heard, nothing. And just ran right into him. And the only reason I saw him is I could see the top of a tree shaking. I'm like, well, that's not normal. And then you look, and there's an elk at the, you know, the elk at the base of it raking his horns. Mm-hmm. So those satellite bulls never made a sound. They never bugled. They never made a peep. But they're circling that big bull and those cows, and they're just raking their horns. And almost killed one of them, and probably could have pushed the issue with the shot. But I just really felt like I could get up there and get on top of that big bull and push him. And I actually ended up getting between him and his cows. And at that point, I thought, oh, well, I got him now. Mm-hmm. And I bugled, and he literally tucked his tail, laid his ears back, and ran away like a scared dog.
Wow.
You sound real mean.
This was a 370 bull, and I did like a little, you know, Horatio horn blower, yeah, baby whistle, baby bugle.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to sound like some of these little 5x5s I'd passed on the way up. And he literally just took off running.
Yeah. We ran into some of that stuff too.
The cows never left. They just sat there and looked and thought, well, what a wuss.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, but yes, those satellite bulls are constantly raking their horns.
Yeah.
Constantly.
You know, that's something.
That's all they do.
I've done raking and calling sequences, but like I've never really put, not that I haven't put thought into it, but it seems like you're just blundering around. Is there, this sounds silly, but like, is there a real technique to raking? Do you find the right type of tree to rake, you know, spruce versus aspen and that sort of thing?
No. No, I don't know that. Just, I don't think so.
Just a tree, make some racket.
I guess. I don't really know the answer to that. Yeah. I don't think there is. I don't think there's really anything definitive there. I mean, I can tell you this. I was walking out one day, and I was walking out this ridge, and I mean, I am not even trying to be quiet. I'm not trying to be stealthy. I'm not going from cover to cover. I'm just dead on my feet, dragging my bow behind me, just 1 foot in front of the other, cannot wait to get to the tent type of walk, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't give a flaming crap if I see an elk or not. I just want to go get horizontal and lay down and get some more water. So I'm just trudging along going up this ridge, and I lift my head and I'm looking, and I see something that doesn't look like it's in, you know, it's totally out of place, and I stop. And this is only 40 yards away. And I stop and I'm looking, and finally my eyes focus, and it's this bull. And he's just standing there, and he's caked up in mud, and he's just standing there looking right at me. And I literally have just walked in the wide open right up to him at 40 yards. And of course, I've got my bow down by my side. I'm not even remotely prepared. And then I look behind him, and there's a cow standing back there. And she's looking, and they're both sitting there looking at me. And for whatever reason, they have not figured out or picked out what I am. And so I very slowly just raise my bow, because it's all I have. I can't bend over and pick a stick or anything like that up. And I raise my bow and I reach in and I'm grabbing an arrow out of my quiver. But as I'm doing it, I start take it's a recurve, you know, so it's a wooden riser bow. I'm pulling the arrow out. I get the arrow out and I take the riser of my bow and I start raking, you know, the little spruce in front of me, just raking the hell out of it with my bow. And this thing immediately, you can see the slobber just start pouring out of his mouth and his nose. He's mad. Mm. But he can't figure out what it is. And I'm just raking like crazy with my bow, you know. And he's looking and he turns around and looks at the cow. And when he turned around and looked at the cow, I knocked an arrow and drew back and killed him. Seriously, I literally had walked right up to him.
Yeah.
And he just never knew. And I said 40 yards, ended up being like 35 yards. Mm-hmm. That's how close I got. But they were probably about to bolt when I started raking that tree with that bow. And they just couldn't put it together on what it was, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
And I mean, literally I didn't have to sidestep or hardly do anything to shoot this bull. I was in the open. He was in the open,
mm-hmm.
But it just, well, I guess we just caught each other off guard. But, I would tell you that last year, I bet you we saw so many bulls that we had never seen if we would not have picked up the top of a tree shaking first while we were glassing.
Hmm.
And then, you know, we go, hey, there's a tree shaking down there. Well, if there's 1,000 trees in your field of view and none of them are moving and one of them is, well, you know, it's not the wind.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so you sit there and watch and then you see that body moving and then you realize it's a, you know, it's a bull. So yeah. Super important. You know?
It's cool. I mean, definitely something I'm going to have to work on some this year and use. You know, it sounds like even if you're fishing, you know, you can use that raking thing. As opposed, you know, everybody uses their bugle. If it's as effective as you say, you could probably do that when you're close to where you know elk bedding is and be more effective because no one's doing it.
Yeah. I've never raked with a bugle. It doesn't sound right to me. I always use a stick.
Yeah.
Or I guess my bow.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that builds my bows, he's built my bows for 20 years. I'll drop two or three off to him and go, man, can you kind of put refinish him? He's like, what in the hell do you do to these things?
It's not like taking a $1,200 stick and just raking it on a tree.
Oh, yeah. Well, I went to longbows because they're so easy to pack.
Yeah.
You know, I can stick them in my backpack and all, but I also like them because I can use them as walking sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, dude, you cannot keep jabbing the end of this bow into these rocks in the ground. I'm like, well, make it out of plastic or steel or something down there because I want to keep using it. You know? But no, I've never used the bugle. It doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think a stick's better. And I mean, it doesn't matter if you break a stick off. I mean, that's what elk do.
Yeah, they do that stuff. Yeah. Especially when they're take off running, they make a whole bunch of noise. Yeah, scary.
I'm telling you though, man, like rolling rocks and stuff, that's huge.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it is huge. I can't begin to tell you how many elk I've had come in looking because you're rolling rocks.
And what do they think is going on? That there's a herd of cows walking and that's where the rocks are coming from?
Well, I mean, think about the elk you guys have heard.
Yeah.
You know, like last year. You hear their hooves on rocks.
Yeah,
you hear
like rocks. Dunk, 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 dunk. Yeah.
Yeah, and you hear rocks rolling and getting kicked around. I mean, they're not quiet animals.
Mm-mm. Well, the horses were running through the woods, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they are incredibly loud. And that's what I was saying earlier. You know, I keep saying you know you're seeing where they're coming from, where they're going, but I'm using the term seeing loosely because a lot of it's just by sound. You're just hearing them going up in there,
observing.
You know.
Observing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a lot of info that Eastern guys can use.
Oh yeah. Yep. Heck yeah, man. I mean, that's why we always like to talk to you about this stuff because, quite honestly, and it is beneficial. Don't get me wrong. Talking to guys who grew up in the mountains and grew up around elk, they have some, a particular set of insights. But to, I don't know, how many, I don't know the percentages, but you got to figure half the guys who are going to hunt elk this year are traveling to at least a different state, right? So there's there's a ton of value in talking to someone who has done the traveling thing and done it well, and that's what you've done, man. So we really appreciate your willingness to always share with us all the vast knowledge that you have, sir, on the podcast and other and otherwise. No, I say it in jest, but for real, man, you're a great guy, a great friend. I really appreciate it, and we really appreciate you know your willingness to share stuff with us, whether on the podcast or whether we're just chit chatting. You also make some great stuff, man. So y'all go check out day6gear.com. Isn't that what it is? Day6gear.com. Oh, he didn't even know his website.
No, yeah. I froze up.
Yeah.
He's blushing. I mean, you guys know I didn't start this to be in the industry whatever. I mean, I just want to help guys be more successful, and it's so much fun being able to see, you know, guys put this stuff to use and come back and go, oh man, you know, this has been a game changer. And whether it's helping somebody tune their bow or get the right stuff, or even help them, you know, find the right place to go hunt or figure out the place they pick that they're gonna hunt. I mean, that's fun for me.
Yeah,
I love it. You know.
Yeah,
and I can say this and vouch for you a little bit here that I don't think that you just saying that to act like a good guy, because you know we met you maybe a week and a half ago or something like that. You were in our state somewhere, and you were just helping out a guy, you know, with some bow stuff. And it's like, man, you drove all the way to Texas to do that. You know, we were wondering why you weren't trying to make millions, you know, over here. But
I don't know how to drill for oil, so I don't really. I'm kind of lost when I get over there.
Yeah, you're on the wrong side of the state.
Yeah, you got to go further west. That's where all that goes down.
It's just fun helping guys. It's fun helping guys become successful and seeing all that, and everybody says that, and it sounds so cliche. So I feel like kind of a banana head saying that, but I really do like it. I mean, I want to see you guys, you know, hooping and hollering and freaking out over a dead bull this year.
Yeah,
you know?
about 200.
But you don't want to see us hooping and hollering over a 90 you know, a 45 inch shed, right?
Oh, you mean to tell me that shed was only 45?
Well, I don't even know if it was 45.
I bet it was 30.
It was pretty small. It was pretty small.
Yeah.
So you're saying the shed was half a 90?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm saying,
thought y'all found a 90-inch shed.
No, did you really? Dude, no way.
Well, I thought y'all found a shed like off of 180.
No.
Not in Texas, no.
No, it's tiny. Tiny deer. It was
pretty small.
And I'm going to shoot a tiny elk this year and be super stoked. So.
I hope you do.
Yeah.
I hope you shoot a cow. I mean, just shoot an elk.
Our goal is for Tyler to shoot his first bull. And then after that, dude, the first legal animal I'm smoking, because I love it, dude. It's just
gonna
so
be
much
hard
fun
for me to pass a cow too.
Yeah,
I don't know where I stand on that right now.
Yeah,
you know, so.
I mean, I'm not gonna judge you at all if you do. Shooting your first elk is gonna be a big deal.
Yeah.
Either way, you know, we come home with two cows in the truck. That's a heck of a trip.
Yeah,
you know, so
cow elk, not Brian cow.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Hold on now, that's how rumors get.
Oh yeah, that's just a judo cow. It didn't really die. Anyways, Brian, dude, good luck this season. I know we're going to talk pretty often, but for formalities, we're going to tell you good luck this season on the podcast. So, anyways, man, thanks for your time and have a good night, brother.
You too, guys. See y'all later.
Now that was some killer info. Don't forget to subscribe, and a 5-star review means a ton to us.
Remember, this is your element.
Living it.
Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, They're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.